Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Carol Kay. This is a rerun from 2007, and Carol Kay's been in the news lately, so I thought it might be interested to revisit this. This is from 2007. You may have seen that this week she was nominated for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a sideman, a side person, a side musician, a studio musician, and she declined their offer. And, of course, I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is garbage. I'm sure their museum is super interesting, but the whole idea of nominating and letting some people in and not some people and the people who decided and how they decided, it's just literally a bunch of garbage. As Johnny Rotten said when he declined, he said, it's a piss stain. And I think that's correct. It's very rock and roll of her. Carol Kay's reasons, you should read about it. Go on her webpage, go on her Facebook page and read about it. I really suggest you do, but I'll sum it up for you. She just says that she, A, thinks that it was really a collaborative effort and just singling out certain people isn't in the spirit of how the records were made. And that's really important to her, that they were a big group collaborative effort. And the second reason is she just is not comfortable with the phrase the Wrecking Crew, which is what that group of musicians who dominated 1960s LA studio work was called after the fact. It's pretty well documented. They were never called that during that time. Hal Blaine, amazing drummer, called them that after the fact. Hal sort of tells the story that the older musicians in LA sort of said, who are these kids? They're going to wreck the business. And that they got called the Wrecking Crew. But it really does seem like that name was not widely adopted until after their work was done and people started writing about it. So Carol never got along with Hal later in their life. They fought during the making of the Wrecking Crew documentary and its promotion. It just kind of went off the track. So I think that has a lot to do with it, her distaste with that name and, I guess, the associations it brings up to her. So check it out. It's been in the news a lot. She's been in the news a lot. And this is a real interesting story. I suggest check out carolkay.com. I also want to tell you that in February 2020, I interviewed her for the Please Kill Me website. If you go to pleasekillme.com, you can search for it, or go to pleasekillme.com/author/Michael-Shelley. You can find my page there, and you can find my Carol Kay interview that way, too. And we cover a bunch of things we don't cover in this interview, which for some reason is only about a half hour long, and I, of course, wish it had been way, way longer. But we do sort of get through her whole career and hear tons of interesting concepts and thoughts about all kinds of interesting things. So here it is from 2007, my chat with legend, 90-year-old bass legend, Carol Kay. Carol Kay, welcome to WFMU. How are you?
Hello. Nice to hear from you, Mike. How are you doing? I'm fine, thanks.
I'm doing great. Beautiful day here.
Enjoying the day out here in the Palm Springs area, you know, because that's where I live right now. But I'm going to be moving back to Los Angeles pretty soon because it's just not my cup of tea out here. It's lovely. The mountains, the air, the weather is just, Garden of Eden, but I miss my guys back in Los Angeles, so I got to go back.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Your parents were both professional musicians, and at age 14, you were a professional musician. How did that happen?
Well, just being dirt poor, man. I had to go out and start playing to put food on the table. I mean, my parents were just the opposites of each other. I mean, my mother was like the church lady and my dad was a rogue, you know, and so when they didn't fight, then they sat down and played music, and I got it very quick when I was young, but we were always very poor, and then when they divorced, then there was nothing. I had to go out to work when I was 9 years old, so eventually I got some music lessons a little bit and took from the same teacher who was teaching Howard Roberts and all the great guitar players out here. People were learning fast in music back then because it was all chordal notes, you know, and the way that they learn today is just terrible. You know, the music education is all note scales and just dumb stuff that doesn't work, you know. So, I mean, so people got it pretty fast, and I got it pretty fast to go out and make some money with it at the age of 14, you know. I mean, nothing spectacular. I mean, I could play some jazz guitar, and that's exactly what happened.
So you were, you know, it's the post-war days, and I guess everyone's going out to see live music, and you were a guitar player,
right,
a very Later in your life, you're really remembered now as being a bass player, but you started as a guitar player.
You know what? There were many women who played fine jazz back then, and the men knew it. You know, you don't see them in the press very much, but they were there. I mean, many women who were out there playing bebop, see? And I was playing in this jazz group, and the producers were scouting around the jazz clubs to try to get the jazz players, because they knew that they could invent lines, see, on the record dates. And along comes this new music called rock and roll, and nobody knew how to write for it or anything, or how to get it together. And so Bunce Blackwell came in the jazz club when I was playing with Teddy Edwards and with Billy Higgins on drums, you know. I worked with them all the time back then. And so it was in 57, and had I been a player of any other instrument, I wouldn't have gotten in studios, but it happened that I was a guitar player at a time that they needed guitar. So they hired me to play fills and back of Sam Cooke, and then it was Ritchie Valens and then the Righteous Brothers and Spector's Bates and all that kind of stuff. And I did guitar in the studio for 5 years.
So those first hits with the guitar, the first session, I think, was a Sam Cooke session, is that right?
Yes. I mean, it wasn't his very first hit, but quite a few records right after that, I'm playing fills on. Not the rhythm. That was Cliff White that was doing the rhythm guitar.
But you're playing on La Bamba, and You've Lost That Love and Feeling,
yeah,
and Surfing,
yeah,
USA. That's some heavy records to be playing guitar on.
Yeah, well, you had to do what you did. I didn't want to do studio work, but it paid so darn good, and you couldn't raise your family on jazz. I mean, I had three kids to support and a mother to support and everything by then. I mean, I threw the men out because they were bad guys or drank too much or something like that.
So,
I was married, three times, you know, so it didn't work out.
So your heart was in jazz, but you wind up here, in the heart of the studio system just as it's developing. So tell me about some of these dates we just talked about. I mean, is your memory good, or is there so many sessions?
Yeah, you kidding? I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I don't use drugs. I don't take pills. Yes. I mean, it's the funniest thing, because as you get older now, I'm 72. And I see guys in their 40s and they can't keep up with me. And I said, see, you smoke too much pot, or you drank too much, or eating junk food. You know, how do you expect to exist when you don't take care of yourself? You know, it's important. The only thing I did wrong was to drink about 10 or 12 cups of coffee a day back then, because none of us got any sleep. You know, we were recording day and night, and a lot of times, instead of going to take a little break to go to the bathroom or make a phone call, I'd lay down on the floor and sleep for 5 minutes, and I still do that, you know. So yeah, it was a grind, but you know what, I didn't hear bass being recorded out here like I kept hearing it in the music. When you play jazz, you invent every note, and you know what should sound good. And all I was hearing was dum, 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 dum. And I get on these days, and I didn't like to play rock and roll on guitar anyway. I was doing all this or ding, 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 you know, all that rhythm stuff and all that stuff. And it got to be a real grind. I miss jazz. But then the bass player didn't show up at Capitol Records one day. I mean, everybody played Fender bass, and then they had a string bass along with them, and then a third instrument called the Dano bass guitar, which was a clicky instrument. It wasn't a real bass. It was a guitar-like instrument. Anyway, and then the bass player didn't show up at Capitol one day, and so I was there, and somebody put a bass in my lap, and I started playing it. I was playing all kinds of notes, bum, boo, doo, boo, doo, ba, da, doo, doo, ba, you know, like lines like that, or doo, 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 ba, doo, boo, boo, you know, the funky lines. I played what I thought should have been on the record. Everybody flipped because I was doing it with the pick, and so the sound was good, and I muted the bass and got the right sound, and then they only hired me instead of three bass players, you know. So the rest was history, and I liked to record then. It was fun to play rock and roll bass and blues and soul and funk and all that kind of stuff on bass. I didn't mind it then, you know.
So, Carol, before that day that someone hadn't shown up, had you played the bass ever?
No. I mean, no, but I did play the Dano bass guitar. I played that on "I'm In With the In Crowd." That Dobie Gray hit. You hear me clicking away on that. It's a certain sound. It's not a real bass. And so they asked me to play the Fender bass. It was a Fender Precision bass that was used on the record dates. And everybody swears by their Fenders because it got a certain sound. It wasn't a really that well made of an instrument, you know, like when you play a Gibson L5 guitar or something. Now that's a real instrument, but the Fender bass was just a board with four strings on. I had to put shims in the neck and stuff like that to make it playable. See, so I used the Fender P bass, and I would trade it in every 2 years just to get the new strings because I had no time to change strings. I'd run into the music store and run out with a new bass just because I could get strings, you know. So yeah.
Well, once you switch to bass, like you said, you were pretty much, you know, number one bassist in that, you know, LA
music. That's right. I mean, they hired me way ahead of anybody else, and I kind of, started the popularity of the pick sound, but that's not my sound. I like the bass to sound like a real bass, you know. But I mean, but they all wanted that click pick because they were used to hearing the Dano. See,
the number of sessions is about 10,000 plus for you.
That's right. But that's not as many as some others claim, you know. We were all doing thousands of dates back then in the 60s, and it was easy to do because we were doing three or four dates a day.
Can you walk?
Now you add that up. Yeah. That's a lot of dates. And we worked on holidays and Saturdays and Sundays. I mean, you're going around the clock, you know.
Walk me through, what is a typical day like for you during that peak time?
I'd get up. By that time, when I was really busy, I got a live-in housekeeper, a Dutch gal, that would take care of my kids and fix meals for them and clean the house and all that kind of stuff. I'd get up and get my wheat germ and my half grapefruit going and a cup of coffee, and I'd run off to the studio, and the cartage company would cart my four amps around, see, and the amplifier would be there. I'd run in with my Fender bass and run in and plug in. The traffic back in those days was not bad in L.A. Yeah, I mean, you could get around. I could get from North Hollywood downtown Hollywood in about 12 minutes. Of course, I drove like a lunatic, and I was putting on my makeup in the car and all that kind of stuff, you know. But I'd get there, find a parking place, run in, plug in the amplifier, which was turned on by the cartage company, and I'd set my settings real quick, and then I'd tune the bass real quick, and I was ready to go. You have to be there on time and ready to record, you know.
Some of the tracks we're talking about in this, you know, compressed time period, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, This Diamond Ring, some Righteous Brothers hits, Chris Montez hits, Simon and Garfunkel hits, The Monkees hits, it goes on and on, and of course the work with Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys.
Yeah, well, Brian was the only cat that wrote his own music lines. We'd go in, and he'd bring the music in, and the notes would be on the wrong side of the stem. I mean, but he knew the music, so he wasn't trained in writing music, but he wrote the parts, and at times we would have to rewrite the parts so that we could read them, but most of those notes were his, and I mean, especially on the bass part, see. He'd tell us what he want, and then he'd go back in the booth, and he'd work from there, you know, and we'd go. He was much like Phil Spector in the sense that he'd work just one tune for the whole date. Most of the time, you cut four or five tunes in the three-hour time period. I mean, we used to brag that we could do an album in 6 hours, you know. We could invent the notes and the tracks and perform and make an album in 6 hours, but there's a few like Phil Spector and Brian that would only work on one tune in 3 hours, you know.
Well, from working with Brian in the beginning, you must have seen this guy blossom as the records got more complicated and more interesting. Was that an interesting process for you?
Yes, it was, because here's this young kid that had a lot of great ideas. I mean, at first he was just another rock and roller. I mean, like Gary Usher and Jan and Dean, you know, that had a few little ideas, and that's fine. We'd bounce off of that and create what we wanted. And then every date he got better and better and better and more creative. I stutter sometimes. Okay, so anyway, so it got so that it got to be fun, and we'd ask each other, are you on the Brian Wilson Beach Boys date today? I says, yeah, oh, that's good. We're going to enjoy this. I mean, he was getting that good, see, so we'd go and work for him, even though it was a tune, three hours. He was fun to work for because he had a sense of humor, a very dry, sense of humor, and he loved us, and we loved him. He was a nice young kid.
It was a different time, and there were bands like Paul Revere and the Raiders or the Hondells.
See, a lot of people get the wrong idea because they think that those groups cut their own records, and that's simply not true. The studio musicians, that was our job, to record hits every day and night of the week.
The Buckinghams.
And so all the groups had us record their tracks for them, and then they'd add on their voices later or something. So, it's hard for the public to understand that here you had a bunch of people as old as their parents, looking very square, with Sears shirts on, jeans and like that, but butch haircuts, sitting there with a droll face. If they put us on stage, we would not be a hit on stage because we'd sit there with a stone face.
Well, you talked about that feeling of being excited to go to a Brian Wilson date. Did the opposite happen too? Did you ever come to a date and say, this is so boring, but were you ever wrong about it and the song became a giant hit?
Yeah, a lot of times. There were dates, like on the Mel Torme date. It's rare for drummers to rush or drag in the studio, so, but in case they did, they might have been sleepy or something. You fixed it up. You did stuff on the bass to kind of get the mood going. When we cut the Gabe's People Play, for instance, he's singing la-dee-da-da-da-da. I'm going boom, 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 the kind of bass line that the song needed. So the band slowed down. It was a live big band, and because the drummer was sleepy, and it got slower and slower, and so one of the guys in the band, Sweets Edison, one of the jazz greats, he says, hey, Carol, do something over there. So I went, beep, boop, boop, beep, 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 and I sped it up so that the drummer finally woke up, and I played a funky bass concerto all the way through the take, and I ran in the booth after it. I says, okay, I think we got it now. I says, that's it. I says, oh no, it's a bass solo all the way, you don't want that, on this tune. And that tune happened to be the biggest money-making hit that Mel Torme ever had. I went home thinking I failed him, because I respected him so much. He's a fine talent.
Yeah, it's a great funky record. I love that cut. Did you see the sort of the end of the studio musician era? Did you see it coming?
Well, I quit purposely in the end of 69. There's a lot of things that happened. Manson was around. My house got robbed. I was sick of doing the cardboard music that we were doing. Even the monkey stuff and all that stuff, that finally got to me, and I said, geez, I just can't cut this rock and roll anymore, this surf stuff. And my kids were growing up. I said, well, my kids are growing up without me, So I quit recording there for a while and wrote my books. I started teaching again. I've been teaching since I was a young kid, except for the 60s, and I taught bass then because everybody wanted to learn what I was creating on the bass and how to get those lines, stuff like that. So I began teaching, and I went back to do studio work in 70, and I only took what I wanted. And I saw it in the 70s. I saw drugs come in the studio in the 70s, too, especially in the record days. It took them months to record an album, something that we could do in 6 hours. But because some of the guys were on, cocaine, and others were on pot, the guys on pot dragged the beat, and the guys on cocaine would run. It just wasn't the same anymore. And then synthesizers came in. I saw the end of it come in the mid-70s, and I was out playing jazz, this time on bass, with Hampton Hawes, So I saw the end coming, and I think a few others did, too. But anyway, it lasted for a while, and then I was crippled up with rheumatoid arthritis by 76, and had to fight that off for quite a while. And I'm fine now. I'm back playing, and I just love it,
That's great. Can you recall some of your favorite sessions, some of the most fun, or some of the records you're most proud to be on?
Joe Cocker, Feeling All Right. that was a groove we just got into. Artie Butler's on piano, and that's Paul Humphrey on drums. I mean, and then we had a conga player by the name of Laudir, L-A-U-D-I-R. We just fell into a groove, and Joe was there and was singing, and it was the most fun. And then the Ray Charles dates. I love Ray Charles, and it's just something about him to work for him. And a few of the Beach Boys, I enjoyed working for Brian. And of course, I mean, Quincy Jones, In the Heat of the Night. The Thomas Crown Affair, I mean, with Michelle Legrand and people like that. You know, when you're doing that kind of stuff now, that's the real thing.
You have a very interesting website. It's full of information, and including some copies of canceled checks, you can see right on the website.
Well, you know, lately, the last 10, 15, 20 years, you have a lot of male players out there that really can't play, and so they assume that women can't play. And it's not true, because like Quincy Jones says in his book, back in the 50s, there were so many great women players that some could leave the men in their dust, and that's what he quotes in his book, and he has my name in there and stuff like that, but that's not the point. The point is that today, men don't know the history of the fine women players that we've always had in this country, you know, since 1910 or so that played with the men, you know. When I was out of sight, I was crippled up and out of sight for a long time, then a couple of guys jumped in and grabbed some of my credits, and then when I came back, I had some surgeries and came back because they fixed up my jaw joint. So I could function. I didn't drag my leg, and I could play again and stuff like that. So when I come back, I said, oh, my God, look at the fees here. So I started the website. So somebody started the website for me. We put on sound clips, and I put up copies just so that guys can see, yeah, I played on that, see? And then I have some sound clips, too. And not only that, but I understand that they do this out of ignorance. They don't know that their favorite hits were cut by studio musicians who were jazz players, and that's why I have the names of our gang up there, too, because trying to educate the public what happened when magazines don't want to talk about us. I mean, record companies don't want to talk about us, because if you'd have seen us, we were blacks and whites working together happily as a family back in the 60s when you had riots and prejudice going on so badly, and they're still trying to keep that illusion that the groups cut their own things, see?
Well, you talk about cutting tracks for Motown under, you know, they would say they were going to cut some demos, and that's how they would pay in cash, and then you found out they were actual Motown records.
Yeah, well, I was the second of nine bass players that they used out here. Jamerson did start the Motown sound on bass, yes, and I've always said that. In fact, I'm the only one that helped him get work out here when he first came out here, too. There was no secret back then about us playing some out here, and of course, they did most of it back there, but there was at least 35% or 40% that was recorded out here. And I'm only one of many bass players that played on the hits. So, but after a while, we got wise that, hey, well, and then when somebody snitched to the union, it was all over, see? So, I mean, so you didn't get paid in cash, you got paid in check, and it was union dates then.
Well, that seems to be sort of the biggest controversy if everyone's trying to figure out who played on what.
Well, you have a guy that came along that never knew Jamerson and wrote a book that has no idea of what happened out here, and he's still trying to deliver his line of baloney out there. He's using Jamerson's name because Jamerson is gone, unfortunately, you know, and in fact he slanders Jamerson too, and that's not right. And then he turned around and sued the gang of players that back in Detroit. Well, they don't need him, you know. So anyway,
are there contracts that sort of will definitively settle this? Are there session logs?
Well, it doesn't have to be settled. If people dig into it, then they'll see the magazine articles that Armin Steiner, the engineer, talks about our Motown dates out here from 62 on. Joe Sample talks about it. There's a lot of magazine articles. Earl Palmer mentions it in his book. Hal Blaine mentions it in his book. It's all over. But, of course, that doesn't get the press. the fellow that wrote the book say, well, poor Jamerson didn't get to be a star. Well, none of us wanted to be stars. I mean, studio musicians are not stars. We're the background guys, you know. So you don't have to settle anything except that you start understanding that the guy that wrote that book will say anything. He lies through his teeth, and, I mean, his credibility is in question. I've always claimed the same credit since 1969 when I wrote my educational books. Always have had the same credits. Jamerson told a big rock star how great I played on some of the Motown things. You know, there is no secret about that. But along comes a guy to hijack a poor fellow's name in order to get his own agenda through, and then turns around and sues the Funk Brothers. Now, you know, I mean, you can add it up for yourself.
It's unfortunate that folks that's what it's come to at this point.
Well, it comes to that because the young guys today can't believe a woman can play like a man, have the balls of a man. Yeah, exactly. It's that thing. And I've always been so, you know, they told bass players out there, play it like Carole Kaye. In other words, play it with balls, you know.
From 1962 or 3 to 1968 or 9, there was this incredible amount of creative work going on in the studios of Los Angeles that you were such a part of. And when people think of the 60s, it really, the music goes such hand in hand with that, you know. It must feel good to sort of be just part of that fabric of the history of America.
Well, thank you. Yes, in a way it is, but it was great to work with the guys. That's what I mean. When I listen to something that we cut, it's, that's Bill Green on sax. Jeez, he sounds good. Or that's Earl Palmer on drums. God, it was fun to play with him. And stuff like that in that sense, you know. So, yeah, it's nice to know that you contributed to people's happiness with those records. But the fact is that none of us really get any credit anyway. I mean, we could brag at some point that we could take anybody off the street. I mean, they didn't have to sing good or anything and turn them into a star, and it was true in a way, you know. But there's a big injustice, I think, done to the whole group of us. It's like there's a whole group of really wonderful musicians, weren't on drugs, weren't on booze or anything, that cut the body of music that everybody knows and loves. And I think that they, as a group, should be recognized and be proud of by this country, because it took a free country to make these musicians happen, see.
Well, Carole, we sort of got to wrap this up. What song should I play to get us out of here?
Well, play the Feeling All Right. That's one of my favorites. Or the Ray Charles, I Don't Need No Doctor, you know, because that's one of my favorites. Any of the Beach Boy things, too, you know, because there's a good spirit on the Beach Boy things. So, thanks. I mean, you're wonderful to talk to because you're very sharp with your questions. I enjoyed that,
well,
you know.
Thank you, Carole. It's really been fascinating just because of your, you know, there's just so much incredible. It really is kind of mind-boggling how many incredible records you play on.
Well, it's not just me. I mean, it's everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody played on a ton of records. But you're right in the sense the bass lines were critical. I mean, with the tune, the beat goes on. It just went dum-de-dum, dum-de-dum. I thought, oh, you got to pull a rabbit out of the hat with this one. So about the third line it came up with was bum-bum-bum-bum-ba-ba-ba-doo-ba. And Sonny heard it, and we recorded the tune with that. And it just, the whole tune came alive.
Sure, that's the hook.
That's the bass line. So I learned early on that bass lines are really critical for the singer and the tune and the whole music thing to happen, you know. So it was fun, you know, for the time. And then working with the guys, I mean, you talk about the best in the world there, you know. They were wonderful guys, too.
Yeah. All right, Carole Kaye, thank you so much for joining us on WFMU, and we'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks, Mike. This has been a nice interview. Thank you.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
We come on the slip, John B. My grandfather and me. Around Nassau town we did roam. Drinking all night. Got into a fight. Well, I feel so breaker, I wanna go home. So hoist up the John B. sail. See. stop the John B. Why stop the John B.? See how the mainsail, see how the mainsail. Call for the captain ashore. Let me go home, let me go home. Wanna go home, let me go home. Stop the John B.
Stop the John B.
Feel so broke up. I wanna go home, let me go home.
The poor cook, he caught the fish. Then he took and he ate up all of my corn. Let me go home. Why don't they let me go home?
This is the worst trip I've ever been on.
Hoist up the John B. Hoist up.
Imagine me and you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love and hold her tight. So happy together. If I should call you up, invest a dime, and you say you belong to me and ease my mind, imagine how the world would be. So very fine, so happy together. See me loving nobody but you for all my life. When you're with me, baby, the skies will be blue for all my life. Me and you and me, no matter how they toss the dice, it has to be the only one for me is you and you for me. So happy together. Toss the dice, it has to be the only one for me is you and you for me. Happy together. I think about you day and night. It's only right when you love a gal to hold her tight and hope and pray that every day you'll be happy together. If I should call you on the telephone, invest a dime and hear you say you're my own. I want you to love me, I want you to need me, because we're happy together. I can see.
Single word, but you know you'll break my heart when I want you
close, close that door,
'cause I know I won't see you anymore.
Don't pour your love out on me, baby. If you do, then I think that maybe I'll just lay me down
right for 100 years.
Don't pour your love out on me, honey. Take my heart, my soul, my money, but don't leave me.
Good to you. What about the
that brand new ring. Doesn't that mean love to you? Doesn't that mean anything? If I threw away my pride and I got down on my knees, would you make me beg you pretty please? Don't pour your love out on me, baby. If you do, then I think that maybe I'll just leave. I wanna do. I've got love enough for two, but I'll never use a girl if I don't have you. Don't pour your love out on me, baby. If you do, then I think that maybe I'll just lay me down, cry for 100 years. Don't pour your love out on me, honey. Take my heart, my soul, my money, but don't leave me drowning in my tears.
And blood, muscle and blood, skin and bones, a mind that's a weak and a back that's strong. You look 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning and the sun didn't shine. I pick up my shovel and I walk to the mine. I loaded 16 tons, a number 9 coal. The straw boss said, get out of that hole, you load 16 tons. And what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. A fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama line. Can't no high tone a woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. The company store.
They took the whole Cherokee Nation, put us on this reservation. Took away our ways of life. The tomahawk and the bow and knife. Took away our native tongue. And taught their English to our young.
Cherokee people, Cherokee tribe. direction. Though I wear a shirt and tie, I'm still part red man deep inside. Cherokee people, Cherokee tribe, so proud to live, so proud to die. But maybe someday when they've learned, Cherokee Nation will return.
We'll return, we'll return, we'll return, we'll return.
County, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the whine. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. and I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.